Gandhi and the Force of Love, and
the other side of it is truth, which Gandhi used as the basis for his term Satyagraha, truth force, which is equivalent with love force, truth force, love force, soul force. It all means the same, so the same reality.
That's James Douglas. We spend the hour with him first talking about Gandhi and his assassination 65 years ago this week, then talking about JFK. Douglas's books are Gandhi and the Unspeakable and JFK and the Unspeakable. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On January 30th, 1948, soon after his country's independence, Mohandas Gandhi was assassinated by a Hindu nationalist. The assassin, Natarajan Godse, was a member of an extremist Hindu nationalist organization. He was angered by Gandhi's efforts to stop the partitioning of the country into Hindu India and Muslim Pakistan, and to forestall the inevitable conflict to follow. In his riveting account of the assassination, my guest James W. Douglas shows the forces of evil that were arrayed against Gandhi and that hoped, by killing him, to snuff out his vision of peace, nonviolence, and reconciliation. His book is Gandhi and the Unspeakable, His Final Experiment with Truth. James W. Douglas is a Catholic spiritual thinker and peace activist. His faith and his activism have moved him to explore the assassinations of JFK, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X. They're all connected, he says, in that they brought the power of hate against the power of love, the power of lies against the power of truth, and the power of violence against the power of nonviolence. Jim Douglas, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
I should say welcome back to Writer's Voice, because the last time we spoke with you, we spoke actually about your book about JFK and the Unspeakable. Tell us, what do you mean by the Unspeakable?
The Unspeakable is where we don't want to go. It's a depth of systemic evil that one would say all our inner and outer controls tell us, don't go there. It must not be named or identified. And Thomas Merton coined the term in relation to evils such as the Holocaust or the Vietnam War, such as the nuclear arms race, genocide, and the assassinations of the 60s. And he referred to it especially in an essay, series of essays he wrote called Raids on the Unspeakable, beautiful book that he wrote.
The Unspeakable is really a political term. It refers to this kind of political violence which threatens to annihilate us all in one way or another. And Thomas Merton was a Christian, a monk, and you yourself are very much in the same tradition of Christian spirituality. Connect the dots for us here between this concept of the unspeakable and the kind of Christianity that you and Thomas Merton follow.
It's a kind of faith that is, in the end, really not afraid of the unspeakable, because the unspeakable is a small reality alongside what Gandhi referred to, what Martin Luther King referred to as the arc of the universe bending toward justice. So if you come from a depth of faith where you feel that is true, it's not a thing that you think is true, but that you know in the depth of your understanding that there is that force in community, in humanity, in all of us, then you're not afraid of the unspeakable. You're not afraid of what is in the darkest shadows and places and is ready to destroy us all, but won't. won't if we draw on that other force.
And that other force is love.
It is indeed. And the other side of it is truth, which Gandhi used as the basis for his term satyagraha, truth force, which is equivalent, as you indicated, with love force, truth force, love force, soul force. It all means the same, so the same reality.
So talk a little bit more about this connection, the analogies between what Gandhi preached and what Jesus preached, because there is a point in your book, Gandhi and the Unspeakable, where he is questioned on this and responds quite to the point.
Gandhi, in my belief, and I am by no means unique in this respect, is the greatest interpreter and practitioner of what Jesus is speaking about in the Sermon on the Mount and what he's living about as he goes to his death. So that kind of an interpreter being alive in our own time gives us an incredible access to Jesus and to Buddha and to all the traditions that Gandhi is drawing upon. For example, Narayan Desai, who I believe is the greatest living disciple of Gandhi, he's the son of Mahadev Desai, Gandhi's secretary. He was with us a few months ago for a retreat. So we felt like we were sitting around, actually moving around. We're trying to move with his thoughts and his real being, in the same way that someone at the end of the first century would be doing so around the last living face-to-face disciple of Jesus of Nazareth. So we're all bound together in pulling the power of the universe through these teachers and through each of us. Gandhi was quite explicit about this. He said, "There's nobody, anybody can do what I did," and he's right. He's absolutely right. Exactly what he did in terms of the powers that he drew upon in our own dimensions, of course, whether you're someone who's working with radio or whether you're somebody who's working with the poor or doing both, or nuclear weapons, or with assassinations, any of these areas, truth at a depth that we don't presently understand it can be unleashed and can transform us.
So what is that soul truth?
It's a harmony, first of all. It's a harmony within ourselves so that when we say something, it comes from the depths of knowing it, not from the depths of deception, which is what a lot of what operates in our culture. And it means that actions correspond to that truth, that reality that's coming from the soul through the heart, through the feelings, through the mouth, through the mind, and then carried out in our actions. Total harmony. And that's what Gandhi called experiments with truth. That is, that the deepest beliefs that he could discover in his life, he would live out. If you don't live them out, they're nothing. But if you live them out, and if you live them out at greater and greater depths, then you're calling on that, you're living out that force through experiments. And, you know, just as powerful, far more powerful than experiments with nuclear weapons or the atom in a spiritual and physical and human and heavenly sense.
And we're speaking with Jim Douglas about his latest book. It's Gandhi and the Unspeakable, His Final Experiment with Truth. Now, he began his experiments with truth in South Africa.
Yes.
He was there. There was a large and impoverished Indian community there.
Yes.
The issue was around what's something called the registration law, and he confronted a powerful enemy, a man named Jan Smuts. Tell us the story.
Well, Gandhi went to South Africa as a total failure, and that, again, is an emphasis upon his belief that anyone can do what he did, because when he was in India, back from England, he was a failure as a lawyer, and so he got a second chance by being offered a job in South Africa, and so That's when he came up against it, the oppression of Indians under the colonizers from England and elsewhere. And Jan Smuts was a leader who had total control in a particular area and finally in the whole of South Africa while Gandhi was there. And he was a very good, in the sense of skillful, manipulator. And he lied and he imprisoned Gandhi. But Gandhi trusted that man beyond what any of Gandhi's co-workers, as he became involved in this enormous Satyagraha campaign in terms of the Indian community in South Africa. He insisted on trusting Smuts whenever Smuts came to a point of negotiation with Gandhi, who, from facing the oppression of Indians, had become a leader almost, but not quite overnight. And he had to realize both that Smuts was a manipulator and also that Smuts was a human being. And that was his experiment with truth, and in a series of places where he was almost killed under the domination of a man who would have been very glad if Gandhi had been killed. But Jan Smuts became a great admirer of Gandhi.
It's an amazing story.
It is.
You know, time after time, I'm not sure that he actually believed Smuts, but he acted as if he believed him.
Yes.
What was it in the relationship between them, in his actions and Gandhi's actions towards Smuts, that won Smuts over?
It was probably Smuts's deviousness recognized by Smuts in the face of Gandhi's truth. It's kind of an interaction between a man who was being the politician he supposed he was having to be, and a man who also was a politician. One must never forget that. Gandhi was a politician before anything else. That's what he said. But a politician who was basing everything on truth, and with the kind of attitude toward his enemy that Jesus of Nazareth spoke about in terms of loving one's enemy. That doesn't mean sentimental kind of love. It means trusting. It means seeking the truth in your enemy. So when Smuts said that he was going to take a step toward the truth by making the law more tolerant of Indians, Gandhi said, I have to believe him. And then he got everybody in his community to go out and obey the very law that they'd all been resisting a few hours before. And Gandhi, of course, did this at great cost, especially when Smuts would betray him. So I think Smuts learned. He learned that you don't have to be the way Smuts thought you had to be, although Smuts continued to be that in many respects after Gandhi left South Africa. And as his parting gift, of course, Gandhi gave to Smuts the sandals that he had made for him in the prison that Smuts had put him in. And he did this as a matter of being his friend.
And over and over again, Gandhi made or tried to make friends with those who wished him ill, those, in fact, who ultimately killed him.
Yes. Gandhi sought to be a friend of the man who was the mastermind of his assassination, Savarkar, Vinayak Damodar Savarkar, and he knew the people who were being manipulated by Savarkar, a very brilliant man, into killing Gandhi. And one of them, for example, had tried to kill him earlier, and Gandhi had said when this other man was arrested, this is the very man who was going to eventually kill him, Nathuram Godse. And when he was arrested, several years before the successful assassination he did at Savarkar's behest against Gandhi, Gandhi said he didn't want him put in jail when the police took him off. He said, what I want is to have that man, whom he regarded as his brother, come live with him for a week. And the police would not do that, but more emphatically, Godse refused to do it. He knew Gotse knew if he lived with Gandhi for a week, he wouldn't be able to kill him.
Right.
It would be impossible. And even when he did kill him by shooting his bullets into him January 30th, 1948, that same man, Gotse, bowed to Gandhi. Well, we can take that in a very, very cynical way, or we can recognize that Gotse knew that even as he was bowing to Gandhi, and Gandhi was in turn bowing to him when he fired his bullets into him, Gotse knew that Gandhi loved him. That is quite a moment to reflect on, that the assassin recognized that the man he was assassinating and thought he had to for political reasons, for nationalistic reasons, thought he had to kill him, he knew that that man loved him.
Can you explain that love to me? I mean, I can understand on the overarching sense how the moral force of nonviolence, how Gandhi believed that that was the most powerful force. But this kind of actual love, love thy enemies, you know, I can't wrap my mind around it.
Well, I agree. I can't wrap my mind around it, too. I don't think we can wrap our minds around it. I find it even more difficult to understand with enemies that are more powerful than Gotse. Of course, Gotse had the power to kill Gandhi and did. But for example, Savarkar or Jinnah. Take Jinnah, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the leader of the new state of Pakistan, who was totally dedicated in the final stage of his life to disrupting and destroying Gandhi's greatest dream, a united India as a nonviolent symbol and power for the world.
Both unity. Hindu and Muslim.
Hindu and Muslim. And Jinnah wanted to, of course, create the nation of Pakistan, which he succeeded in doing. Well, Gandhi, in that very final stage where Jinnah was doing everything he could to destroy Gandhi's dream, and, of course, Gandhi was talking with him all the time about it. Gandhi talked with everybody, especially the ones who wanted to destroy his vision. He secretly, without Jinnah's knowledge, talked to Mountbatten, the man who Britain had sent out to create these two separate nations, because the British wanted to divide again. They were always dividing in order to keep the power as much as possible, even when independence was created for India. Jinnah was nominated by Gandhi secretly to Mountbatten as Gandhi wanted him to be the Prime Minister of India. His enemy, his greatest enemy, the man who was destroying everything. What Gandhi felt, and I think rightly, with brilliant political perception based on love of enemy, was that if Jinnah was named the Prime Minister of India, there would be no Pakistan, because mm-hmm. Jinnah would be the leader of a united, much more powerful nation than the one that he wanted to create. And I think that would have happened had not Gandhi's own allies, his Congress Party allies, and especially Nehru, who would, of course, not become premier or prime minister if Jinnah became it. They blocked it. They blocked it. And so that's an example of Gandhi seeing his greatest enemy as the salvation of United India. An incredible insight based on a willingness to go far farther than we can imagine with an enemy.
Savarkar, I'm sure, believed that he was a patriot.
Yes, he did.
Gotse believed he was a patriot.
Yes.
Perhaps Jinnah also the same.
I'm sure.
This is a controversy, a struggle between two points of view, the view of the need for revolutionary violence against the belief in revolutionary nonviolence that continues today. I mean, we can see, take for example the issue of Syria, or as many, many people, including one of the characters in your book, the people in your book, Gandhi and the Unspeakable, Jim Douglas, people have said, what about Hitler? So There are many who would say that nonviolence would not have worked against Hitler. We're not even sure that nonviolence worked in India because Gandhi's vision wasn't fulfilled. In Syria, people are being slaughtered by, the hundreds and thousands. Are we to really say to the Syrian revolutionaries, you should not fight back?
We should say to ourselves and to everybody who wants to respond in ways that we hope we can do, that it's up to us as to whether and to what extent nonviolence, quote, works. Well, it won't work in many instances. Let's use the term in the way that it is usually used, which involves immediate results. Nonviolence certainly didn't work for a number of the witnesses to it under Hitler. One I think about a lot is a guy named Franz Jägerstätter, an Austrian, and he was very isolated, and he was beheaded under Hitler because he refused to cooperate with Hitler, and everybody around him said he had to do what the Nazis told him. And that meant all his family members were telling him that, and his priest was telling him that, his bishop was telling him that, all the people in the village were telling him that, and the guy went to his prison and his execution. Well, quite a few years after that now, that man is the best-known person from his village, from his area, and has inspired thousands, if not millions of people to take steps toward nonviolence. So, no, nonviolence didn't work for Franz Jägerstätter. He died very quickly. But it has worked in very good ways for lots of people who had powers of getting together and living and perhaps dying themselves in even more transforming ways than Jägerstätter did. I just use him as a tiny example. Nonviolence working means, I think, in Gandhi's case, working in our conversation right now. Gandhi didn't die on January 30, 48. He's as much alive today in the world as he was in the 78 years when he was walking on the earth, because, in fact, I think he's much more alive now. The so-called Arab Spring sprang a huge power of Gandhi all over the place. And when I say Gandhi, of course, he's symbolizing Jesus and Buddha and the whole power at that center of the universe. So nonviolence working, I think, means where are we going to be when this history of ours evolves to the point of ultimate questions? Are we going to have a new humanity, or are we going to have a nuclear wasteland and oceans rising to the point where they cover the earth and heat just saturating us all with, are we going to have that kind of world, or are we going to have a world with a new kind of creature that we call truly human? And then we'll know whether nonviolence works or not.
So you mentioned non-cooperation. Could you say a little bit more about what that means? And give us the example of the SALT March, because that was more than non-cooperation, that was action.
The SALT March came from the power that was given Gandhi by the Congress Party in India to come up with a means of non-cooperation with the British. And Gandhi was very measured about it, very prayerful. He didn't jump to any conclusions. He didn't know what he wanted to do with the leadership he was given. He just thought and he thought, especially, of course, in the context of living, just as the poor of India did, or as close as he could get to it, and he thought about salt and about the tax that was placed on a basic human commodity that was used by poorest of people there. And so he devised this tactic of simply walking to the sea and picking up a bit of salt, which he wasn't legally allowed to do by the British. Regarding the salt that was in the Indian people's own land and beaches. And so off he went, leading a group of pilgrims to the sea. And, of course, when he picked up that piece of salt, he did a symbolic action watched by India and the world and the British imperialists that ignited millions of people non-cooperating in every way they could with the what the law that said they weren't allowed to have salt, to use salt, to sell salt, to buy salt. They did it all. And that was the end right there of the British power, although it took another couple of decades for it to work itself out. May I say something further about non-cooperation? Mm-hmm. When you asked that question, before you said the salt march, I was going to say, oh, you mean what we should do on April 15th? Because I was thinking of it in our own context. On April 15th, if we pay our taxes, we pay for all the wars that the United States is carrying out right now. So the question of non-cooperation is not one that relates only to Gandhi and the Salt March. It relates more specifically to the bottom line of how the wars are paid for that may cost us a world, namely our own wars.
And, of course, this is something, you know, very real for us today. I mean, we elected a president who got the Nobel Peace Prize and has, in fact, gone to war as much as, if not even more than, his predecessor. And someone who also does quote, as you say, Martin Luther King and the eventual arc bending towards justice. Could you comment on that?
He's a reflection of ourselves. I think in as much as we're talking about especially the politics of assassination, you connected this as the program began with John F. Kennedy. I think the president is a very brilliant and good human being, and that he's very much aware of what happens to someone in his office, as happened to his predecessor, John Kennedy, if he goes the other way. And I think he might put it in terms, you know, more self-sacrificing than simply his own welfare. I mean, he doesn't think he's going to be replaced by anybody better if he gets assassinated right off the bat because he's moving against what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. So we've got a very good man who feels he has to do certain things and can get a few good things done within that context. Well, one hopes for more than that, but one hopes for more than that initially upon ourselves, because a president of the United States is going to move until we move, and we aren't going to move until we make steps like not paying for war and dedicating our lives totally to justice and peace in the way that someone like Gandhi would do in order to draw on that power at the heart of the universe. And Obama is very specific about it. He says, the power doesn't begin here in D.C. It begins in those who are outside that kind of power. He said that on a number of occasions when he's talked about Gandhi himself.
He has talked about that, but he's also cracked down on people making the attempts to do exactly what he asked the people to do in his acceptance speech before the inauguration, you know, when he got elected. There's just a terrific crackdown that happened on the Occupy movement, on the 99%. It's been brutal, and I don't think we can put it all to Obama, but we can say that his Justice Administration has been a very active arm of that.
He must be held accountable for all of that. But unless we are willing to face the unspeakable in our own history and say that the last president who faced up to that in a conscientious and courageous way, John F. Kennedy, was assassinated by that very force, until we are willing to name and deal with the unspeakable, we're going to have presidents who will carry out the unspeakable's wishes. And we've got to deal with that ourselves. And Obama will follow in the footsteps of the people if the people lead.
James Douglas. His latest book is Gandhi and the Unspeakable, His Final Experiment with Truth. We'll talk more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with author, Catholic spiritual thinker, and peace activist James Douglas about his book, Gandhi and the Unspeakable. It's part of a body of work looking at the spiritual powers of truth and love in politics and how that is confronted by unspeakable evil. I asked Douglas why he's devoted so much of his life to exploring the confrontation between nonviolence and violence in politics in explicitly spiritual terms, focused on the issue of the assassinations of leaders.
In my case, it's a matter of vocation. As for all of us, we get called certain ways. And my turn toward nonviolence as a way of life rather than as a subject that I talked about in a university was through the assassination of, not John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. And I was in the University of Hawaii in 1968 when that happened, and my students formed a group called the Hawaii Resistance. They went to jail for up to 2 years, 6 months to 2 years, depending on the person we're talking about. In that group, I went to jail with them for a much shorter period of time because I was only arrested for, blocking convoys and things of that sort. But it ended my academic career. It turned me toward working on peace and justice full-time, and it turned me toward trying to understand the source of my conversion to nonviolence, which was Martin Luther King giving his life for it. And it wasn't because some odd guy shot him because the odd guy happened to be a racist. That's all a myth. He was killed by the government of the United States of America, the same government that has declared his birthday a holiday, killed King. Well, you go from there to Kennedy because you start thinking about, well, what about those other folks who were killed around that time? And you begin to understand that November 22, 1963, legitimized killing by the United States of America, our government, whenever some kind of force in this country rises up that can transform it. And I don't mean that it has to be Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or Robert Kennedy. I mean anybody. And so unless we deal with that, that's going to happen to any of us at any time, because it's been legitimized, and it's legitimized to the point where the President of the United States, the one we were speaking about, picks out people practically every day of the week almost in his Oval Office who can be assassinated around the world by our drones and by our other means of killing. This has all been legitimized by November 22, 1963, and are not dealing with that. So the other power on the other side of the spectrum is Gandhi. It's the power of nonviolence and the power of truth, telling the truth about all of these atrocious events that we will not deal with in our own history. And until we deal with them, we can't deal with the present.
As we end this, you've talked about taxes, but what are other ways? What is necessary for us to shift inside ourselves to do what Gandhi did?
Maybe just be silent a little bit in terms of the piece of ground we stand on or live on, and what seems hardest to do in a good way on that piece of ground. And that's the place to begin. I'm not too much on, beginning with the global thought. It's so much as beginning with the piece of ground where the Buddha is, which of course is ourself, and what can I do where I am right now in the net of relationships that I'm in, and in terms of a vision like Gandhi's, which is experimenting with the power of truth, my power of truth, whether I'm a Buddhist or I'm a Muslim or a Christian or a humanist, and the truth of living out what I believe most deeply. If we can begin, because I becomes a relationship immediately, otherwise it's nothing, what can we do right here? And maybe just get together in a small group and think about it. And whether it's the immigration law, I'm talking from Birmingham, Alabama, which we've got the worst immigration law in the country, or whether it's the racist violence is about to destroy a Muslim community trying to build a mosque, which is happening right now in a town not too far from us. All these kinds of things are possibilities for taking an enormous step of truth, love, and nonviolence.
Jim Douglas, your book is, it's a short book, but an absolutely gripping one, fascinating and thought-provoking, Gandhi and the Unspeakable. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
James W. Douglas. Now let's listen back to an excerpt from my 2009 interview with him about his book, JFK and the Unspeakable. Douglas says JFK was assassinated because he went against the military-industrial complex to, in effect, end the Cold War. Like Gandhi, he was a force for peace against violence. It all centered around the Cuban Missile Crisis. Kennedy was playing a double game. Publicly, he was talking tough on Cuba, but privately, he was seeking a rapprochement with Khrushchev that could solve the crisis. At the time, Douglas was criticizing Kennedy's public stance in published articles.
So while my articles were counter his public positions, as I learned in many years later, he was taking private positions that corresponded to what I hoped a leader like he would take. For example, pulling missiles out of Turkey at the same time as Khrushchev was pulling missiles out of Cuba, reciprocal kinds of things, and disarmament policies that went far, far beyond his own national security state.
Now, you mentioned how you had seen Kennedy. I was 13 when he was assassinated.
Yes.
But I have a much more vivid memory, actually, even of his assassination, and that is of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes.
I was telling a young friend of mine today that I remember that time very, very well. I remember the feeling that I had that of imminent annihilation at any point. I remembered walking to school and looking up nervously at the sky. Every time a plane went overhead, I thought that was it. So my experience of Kennedy, even though, you know, I was just a young girl, really, my experience of him was as a cold warrior. And yet, there's a much more nuanced picture that you paint in this book, and you say it had everything to do with why he was assassinated. Could you just tell us, just sketch out for us, what are the most salient parts of what you think led to his assassination? And then maybe we'll go into each one a little more deeply.
Early in his presidency, he had a sharp conflict with the Central Intelligence Agency, and that deepened as he went along. The event was the Bay of Pigs, and he felt that he had been deeply manipulated and lied to by the CIA to put him in a false position where he would be forced to do what he had said he would absolutely not do, which was send U.S. troops into Cuba or reinforce the exile brigade that the CIA had trained with U.S. forces. He said he wouldn't do that. But they set him up, he realized afterwards, by lying to him about a revolution they knew was not going to occur in Cuba, a counter-revolution against Castro, and with terrain where the CIA-trained exiles could not go into a kind of retreat if necessary. He'd been set up in a whole series of ways. Afterwards, he said, I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds.
So you're actually saying that they knew it was going to fail, and they wanted to set, that the Bay of Pigs, they wanted to send in these paramilitaries.
Yes.
So that they would fail, so that the U.S. would have to invade Cuba.
Exactly. And the invasion, of course, they knew would be huge because the U.S. had the forces to overwhelm Cuba, but Kennedy was totally opposed to doing such a thing. But he realized that they had set him up that way. And we even have, as I've cited, the notes of Alan Dulles acknowledging that in things that he never wrote publicly. And there are many sources today, including government sources, for this having happened. There's not any real question it happened.
Well,
what is significant is Kennedy's response to it.
So before you tell us that, tell us who Alan Dulles was.
He was the legendary CIA director who, throughout the 1950s, controlled covert action throughout the world for the Central Intelligence Agency. And it was during those years that, working also with his brother, John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State under Eisenhower, that Alan Dulles was creating all kinds of coups, assassinations, sabotage all over the world on behalf of the U.S. as part of the Cold War. So Alan Dulles was no small figure in U.S. intelligence. He was the major figure, and Kennedy fired him. He fired him after the Bay of Pigs, and he fired his chief lieutenants because of what they did. And then who winds up as being the key member of the Warren Commission investigating Kennedy's murder? Alan Dulles. So we've got the Fox investigating the murder in the hen house. He should have been identified as the chief suspect.
So what kind of sources do you have to back up your claim that Dulles was in fact the fox on the Warren Commission?
The way in which he acted on the Warren Commission is is heavy evidence of the cover-up. He was working adroitly. Of course, he had been fired from the CIA, but he was still very, very close to the CIA. And he was passing communications back and forth to the man who had worked under him, Helms, who was director of covert action within the Central Intelligence Agency, and other people within the agency to give them everything that the Warren Commission was working on, and vice versa, to shield from the Warren Commission critical information within the CIA. So there isn't really any paper trail or any trail that you could say identifies Dulles as the mastermind of the assassination. But as for being a key player in the cover-up, that's easily established by Warren Commission documents and CIA documents and what was going back and forth between him and the CIA.
So why did the CIA want to go into Cuba, and why would John F. Kennedy want to thwart that?
Well, the CIA was a part of a much larger reality, our national security state, and that was part of a further huge reality, the Cold War. And we had a kind of overarching theology, which continues to be an overarching theology. It's us versus them, absolute good versus absolute evil, the free world versus the communist world. And within the, quote, free world, we had to defend our nuclear weapons especially. And that meant covert action of all kinds to counter what we saw as the communist evil designs at every point over against us. And certainly there were things going on counter to us of a suspicious nature. And so a doctrine called plausible deniability was created under the National Security Council, and it meant that the CIA was authorized in those days, and this continues to be the case today, to carry out what we would regard as criminal actions, overthrowing governments, assassinating people, sabotaging, doing all kinds of lying, propaganda, and to deny that plausibly. In other words, there could be no real connection between what the CIA did that could be really visible and its source in the United States government. And that became so proficient that it enabled the Central Intelligence Agency to coordinate the murder of the President of the United States.
That's a pretty major allegation that you've made, that it was the U.S., that in fact this was an extrajudicial murder by the national security establishment itself.
Yes.
You know, there are an awful lot of people who have thought this and claimed this, and, you know, they've been dismissed as conspiracy theorists. What makes your book different than theirs? What makes you, what have you done that you feel has been, you know, because you don't have the kind of background that's typical, let's say, of a, quote, conspiracy theorist, unquote.
No.
So tell us, what has made your book different?
Well, this is the story of John Kennedy. It's not the story of the plot, although I tell the plot, and the plot is necessary. But it's the story of a person who turned, turning. That's a biblical concept. The Hebrew is shuva, and Greek it's metanoia, and we translate it repentance. But the meaning of it is turning against a way that was destructive toward a way that is peaceful and just, the way of the Creator. And Kennedy did that, and he was, just as you understood him, a cold warrior. He was a person who ran for office as President of the United States with a very militant platform, very militant in regard to Cuba and the Soviet Union, and his inaugural address has elements of that, although it also has elements, peaceful elements. But Kennedy turned, and partly it was in reaction to the way in which he was being manipulated by his own national security state, the way also Truman and Eisenhower had been. But Kennedy decided to be president of the United States rather than to take orders from his national security state. So as things moved along, he took a stand in the midst of the missile crisis that was absolutely critical to our survival as a people and to the survival of the world. And that's the most significant turning point. And from that point on, he and his enemy, Nikita Khrushchev, begin to work together. And that's the beginning of the end of John Kennedy, and also, not incidentally, of Nikita Khrushchev in the Soviet Union.
Really?
Neither became tolerable from the standpoint of his own national security state.
Wow, I didn't know that Nikita Khrushchev also suffered from that. It's a remarkable story you tell in the book. Jim Douglas, the book is JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. Just kind of give us the cliff notes of that remarkable friendship, in fact, that developed between these two leaders, JFK and Nikita Khrushchev.
They only met one time in their lives, and that was in Vienna. And the meeting didn't go especially well, and they did begin to negotiate on some key issues. But in that meeting, Kennedy, in an aside, suggested to Khrushchev that they needed to talk or communicate less formally, rather than being under the lights and the cameras and with microphones all over. And so they began a secret correspondence. And the first letter came from Khrushchev that fall when they were in the midst of a huge crisis over Berlin. And Khrushchev wrote a beautiful letter to Kennedy reflecting on the Black Sea where he had his home. And he used a biblical symbol. This is the communist Khrushchev choosing Noah's Ark as the symbol of what he and Kennedy had to do, keep the Ark afloat in a sea of nuclear weapons. And Kennedy, after he had this letter smuggled to him in a newspaper that was handed to his press secretary by a KGB agent posing as a press person, Kennedy responded to that beautiful letter by one of his own, writing from Hyannisport beside the sea also, and reflecting similar fashion and saying, yes, the Ark is our symbol, let us keep that Ark afloat. And so in their secret correspondence, they struggled with these issues, contentious issues between them, but they began, almost in spite of themselves, to trust each other. So when it came to their huge conflict in the missile crisis, in which Kennedy thought Khrushchev had lied to him, he in fact had lied to him, and snuck missiles into Cuba, but of course Khrushchev thought Kennedy, since his forces had already invaded the Bay of Pigs in terms of the Cuban exile community, they might do it again, that they needed nuclear weapons to deter the U.S. I mean, each of them had a piece of the truth. But in the midst of the missile crisis, then, they had as a foundation their relationship in these letters. And when Kennedy found himself losing control to his generals, who were doing all kinds of things to provoke the Soviet Union in a way that could then give us an excuse or give them an excuse for an all-out missile attack to, quote, win the Cold War, Kennedy sent Robert, his brother, the Attorney General, secretly to the ambassador of the Soviet Union in Washington and appealed for help. They couldn't get out of the situation, and they were afraid that the generals were going to, if not take over, at least provoke a war. And Dobrynin, he wired, that he was the Soviet ambassador, he wired Khrushchev, and Khrushchev, when he got this message, he turned to his foreign minister in Moscow and said, amazingly, we have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him. And the foreign minister couldn't believe what he was hearing, and Khrushchev almost couldn't believe what he was saying, and he repeated it, and he said, yes, we now have a common cause to save the world from those pushing us toward war. And at that moment, everything turned upside down in the Cold War, and John Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev became closer to each other in their perceptions in the midst of a darkness where we'd almost had a nuclear war than either was to his own national security state. And that's the story. That's the essence of it. And that's the astounding turning of not only Kennedy, but also Khrushchev.
Now, Kennedy secretly taped some conversations in the Oval Office during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Talk about those.
He taped virtually all of them. These were conversations of all his national security advisors. There was a group called the Executive Committee of the National Security Council, a specially designated group to carry him through the missile crisis, and deliberated at great length on each part of the struggle on what to do. And the meeting that reveals most profoundly Kennedy's position and his alienation from the military is a meeting with his Joint Chiefs of Staff. It's just him alone, nobody else, and the Joint Chiefs, the heads of all the different services, Army, Navy, Air Force, and so forth. And General Curtis LeMay is the major counter to Kennedy, and is really not only arrogant, but dismissive of the president, and telling him that his position of a quarantine, actually a blockade around Cuba, is as bad as the compromises with Hitler before the Second World War. And he's just insulting him. And Kennedy refuses to go with the Joint Chiefs' pressures to invade Cuba or to bomb Cuba. He very politely tells him that that's not going to be done. And then he walks out of the room. Of course, this is all on tape, and the tape keeps recording, and we hear LeMay and the other generals not only dismissing Kennedy, but doing so in very, very violent and abusive language, and saying that it's up to them to see that what has to be done does get done.
And what they wanted to do was to bomb Cuba with nuclear weapons.
That's exactly right. And General Curtis LeMay, who's head of the Air Force, had authorized, not with Kennedy's support, Kennedy didn't even know what was happening, shooting test missiles out into the Pacific in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis from an airfield that also had nuclear-loaded missiles on it. So the Soviets would have been unable to distinguish one from the other. Fortunately, they didn't begin to respond because the Air Force was all ready to massively attack and create a nuclear war outside the boundaries of anything Kennedy knew about or wanted.
It's really chilling.
It was very, very close, and Kennedy realized that and appealed to Khrushchev, who realized it from his standpoint because he had similar messages and he had similar pressures in his own situation.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with James W. Douglas about his book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. Back to Cuba, actually, there's another very interesting parallel development to the rapprochement between Kennedy and Khrushchev, and that's the one between Kennedy and Castro.
Yes. Well, Castro was very much alienated from Khrushchev because of the Cuban Missile Crisis. We have to remember that the reason those missiles were there from the standpoint of Castro and Khrushchev, too, to a large degree, was to deter an invasion from the superpower to the north of Cuba, the United States, which had already been involved in the Bay of Pigs. So for Khrushchev to respond to Kennedy's appeal without consulting Castro, which is exactly what he did, because of the lack of time and also feeling that Castro would have reservations and that would delay it even further and they'd have a nuclear war in the meantime, Khrushchev had not consulted Castro. He just said publicly that I'm going to withdraw the missiles in return for Kennedy saying that he didn't plan to invade Cuba. Well, so what's Castro got on his part? Nothing from his standpoint except the promise of the capitalist president to the north. He doesn't have the missiles any longer. So Castro was furious with Khrushchev, furious with him, and he wouldn't even communicate with him. He just broke off all communication. So Khrushchev finally persuaded Castro half a year later to come to the Soviet Union for a rapprochement between the two of them so that they could become allies and comrades again. And during that month that Castro went with Khrushchev around the Soviet Union, Khrushchev, of all things, gave him a teach-in regarding his secret correspondence with Kennedy. He kept reading him letters about how they were negotiating for peace now.
A teach-in, you said?
A teach-in, yeah. He was literally reading for hours on end all this correspondence from between him and Kennedy to Castro. And Castro is just trying to figure all of this stuff out. But he convinced Castro that Kennedy was someone they could work with. So Castro went back to Cuba convinced of that and was all ready when he received feelers from Kennedy as to whether or not he was interested in a dialogue with the President of the United States. And there were signs of that already in the spring of 63 because Kennedy was blocking CIA raids on Cuba to the consternation of the CIA, which kept, you know, raiding at a point where Kennedy was absolutely against it. So he was arresting members of the CIA and Cuban exile operatives for them, putting them either in jail or keeping them from going out on the water at all in Cuba. And Castro recognized that Kennedy was taking very positive steps. And then in the fall, when Kennedy actually sent messages to Castro through an intermediary in the United Nations, Castro was ready, thanks to Khrushchev. So there was this incredible underlying connection between these three leaders that was ending in a foundational way the Cold War, and we out here were totally unaware of it.
James Douglas. Douglas is a longtime peace activist and Christian theologian. With his wife, Shelley Douglas, he co-founded the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action in Washington State and Mary's House, a Catholic worker house in Birmingham, Alabama. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.